This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The War of the Dwarves, written by Marcus Heitz, translated by Sally Ann Spencer, read by Neil Dixon. Dedication. For those who understand the grandeur of the dwarven folks. At the Battle of the Black Saddle, trolls were wailing, orcs whimpering, and our battle-hardened warriors were close to despair. But I never saw a dwarf lose heart. Pal Duril, personal guard to Liutasil of Alandur, Lord of the Elves. On the nature of dwarves, commonly found in gloomy mountain caverns, these diminutive creatures will fell an Orcus Gigantus with a single blow of their deadly axes, for no weapon in Gerd Lagard can match the finely fashioned axe of the dwarves. Afterward, they will drink beer by the barrelful without discernible effect. Such is the resilience of the dwarven female. From Notes on the Races of Gerd Lagard, Singularities and Oddities, from the archive of Viranciensis, Kingdom of Tabane, compiled by the Master of Folklore, M. A. Het, in the 4299th solar cycle. Death came for the dwarf and tried to take him, whereupon the warrior squared his shoulders, dug his heels against the granite floor, and told him to go. Death turned around and left. Apologue from the southern provinces of Sangpur. Part 1. Prologue. Borengar's folk, eastern border of the Firstling Kingdom, Gerd Lagard, winter 6234th solar cycle. Swirling and dancing like giddy ballerinas, snowflakes tumbled from the sky. Carried by the wind, they scattered over the mountains and came to rest among their fellows, covering the red range like a great white cloth. Snow had been falling for many orbits, and the grey clouds continued to unburden themselves, burying the slopes. Some of the drifts were deep enough for 10 dwarves to stand on each other's shoulders and disappear from view. From his vantage point on the second highest of 9 towers, Boendal Hookhand of the clan of the Swinging Axes gazed out to the east. Dressed in chainmail and a thick fur coat to protect him from the cold, the secondling warrior for Berowyn's folk was standing watch in East Ironhald. The stronghold built by the firstlings on the eastern border of their kingdom was protected by twin ramparts as wide as houses that rose out of the mountainside, enclosing 8 watchtowers connected by bridges at a dizzying height. Further back, the 9th tower stood alone. A single bridge, broad enough to accommodate a unit of dwarfs, led into the mountainside where the firstlings had made their home. The western flanks of the Red Range were protected by another stronghold, almost identical in structure. The formidable defences of West Ironhald were a bulwark against the orcs and other creatures seeking entry from the outer lands. Boendal, stranded for orbits in the Firstling Kingdom, was impatient to leave.
"How much longer, Vrakus?"
He fought back a yawn. On clear nights, the white slopes shimmered prettily in the moonlight. But Boendal was inured to the view. Besides, there was something menacing about the glistening blanket of snow. Battlements, watchtowers, and bridges had to be cleared on a regular basis to protect the masonry from its crippling weight. The stronghold had been built to withstand the fury of invading trolls, boulders the size of an orc, and battering rams powered by ogres. but no one had reckoned with so much snow.
"Weather's coming from the west,"
muttered one of the sentries, peering balefully at the sky. His breath turned to miniature clouds that froze against his bushy beard and covered his whiskers in a layer of ice. Sniffing loudly, he walked to the brazier and filled his tankard from the vat of spiced beer that was simmering at the perfect temperature. Pleasantly warm, but not hot enough for the alcohol to boil away. In no time, the tankard was empty. The sentry burped, refilled the vessel, and offered it to Boendal.
"With a storm like this, you'd expect the weather to be coming from the north."
Boendal clasped the tankard gratefully. On crisp winter nights, warm beer was the best antidote against the creeping chill. His chainmail shifted noisily over his leather jerkin as he lifted his arm to drink. He winced. The wounds in his back were healing nicely, but the slightest movement had him gasping with pain. The sentry shot him an anxious look.
"Are you all right? I've heard stories about Alvish arrows. They leave terrible wounds." "The pain is a reminder that I'm lucky to be alive. Vrakas had his work cut out to save me."
The events of that orbit were vivid in his mind. He and his companions had been riding toward East Ironhald when the Alfar attacked from behind. Two black-fletched Alvish arrows had ripped through his chainmail, tunneling into his back. The physicians had struggled for hours to stem the blood.
"I owe my life to Vrakas and your kinsmen. They took me in and tended my wounds."
There was a brief silence before he inquired,
"How about you? Have you ever done battle with an Alf?" "I've fought orcs and ogres, but we seldom see Alfar in these parts. Is it true they look like elves?"
Boendal nodded.
"They're the spitting image of their cousins, tall, slender, and fleet-footed. But their hearts are full of hate. We should have killed the ones who brought you down. It won't be easy for your friends with a pair of Alfar on their tail."
The firstling shifted his gaze to the northeast. The dwarves' last hope, the dragon fire furnace, was burning in the Fifthling kingdom, where Boendal's companions were forging a weapon to kill the Dark Magus, whose tyranny had brought Gerdlegard to its knees.
"Tongdil will manage," Boendal assured him. "My twin brother, Boindil, and the rest of the company will forge the axe and kill Nodon. I've heard of keen fire. But what use is an axe against a wizard?"
The firstling's voice was tinged with doubt.
"Keen fire has the power to destroy demonic spirits. It says in an ancient book that the blade will slay Nodon and kill the evil inside him. Nature's order will be restored."
Boendal looked the firstling in the eye.
"We can't fail, and we won't. Vrakas created us to protect the people of Gerdlegard, and we won't let him down."
He took a sip of spiced beer and felt the warmth spreading through him.
"What of your queen?"
he asked to dispel the silence.
"Is there news of Xantis?"
Orbits earlier, the firstling queen had set off on an underground journey through Gerdlegard. The five dwarven kingdoms were connected by a network of tunnels with wagons that ran on metal rails. The system, a masterpiece of ancient dwarven engineering, enabled the folks to travel at speed in any direction by means of artificial gradients, switching points, and ramps.
"We don't know where she is,"
the firstling muttered unhappily, pulling on his beard.
"She left here for a meeting, not to do battle with Nodon. We're praying to Vrakas that she and our kinsmen are safe."
He continued to tug on his beard while his left hand rested lightly on the parapet.
"I can't stand the waiting."
He looked at Boendal.
"But who am I telling? You're here every time I'm on watch, morning, noon, and night. Don't you sleep?"
Boendal gulped down the rest of the beer.
"My companions are risking their lives to save Gerdlegard. I couldn't sleep if I wanted to."
He returned the tankard to the firstling.
Thank you. It's given me strength and warmth.
He pulled his fur coat around him and gazed at the unbroken expanse of snow. His eyes settled on the gully, the only route into the stronghold from Girdlegard. Secretly, he hoped that if he looked carefully, he would see his brother and the rest of the company hurrying toward him through the snow.
The most important mission in history, and they had to go without me, he thought gloomily.
The wounds in his back and the blood loss had conspired to keep him to his bed, and by the time he recovered, his friends had departed. It was too late to chase after them now. Boendal, who was famous for his skill with a crow's beak, knew his strength would be missed in the battle against Nodon.
You wanted me to stay here, didn't you, Vrakus?
He clenched his fist.
I expect you've got your reasons, but I'd rather be with Boindil.
Closing his eyes, he pictured his friends. First he saw Bavrogor Hammerfist, the one-eyed mason who liked to drink and sing. Bavrogor had tricked his way into the company with customary cheek. Then came little Goimgar Shimmerbeard, the nervous fourthling diamond cutter, whose beard glittered brightly with the dust of countless gems. The company's leader was Tungdil, the kind-hearted, brown-haired outsider, whom Boendal and his brother had befriended when he was a foundling with a scraggy beard. The twins had taught him how to be a proper dwarf, and the three of them were very close. After a rocky start, Tungdil had proven himself as an able leader. Boendal didn't know much about his new smith, Belindis Steelfinger, a firstling who had joined the expedition while he was ill. And the fifth dwarf was his twin brother, Boindil Doubleblade, known as Ironheart because of his hot blood. Boindil was thick-set and muscular with shaven cheeks, a black beard, and long hair that reached to his knees in a plait. Most of the time he seemed a little crazy. His fiery spirit gave him formidable strength on the battlefield, but it was also a curse. Boendal opened his eyes. It was reassuring to think that his battle-hardened twin was with Tungdil.
Vrakus, lend them your strength.
Wind gusted over the mountains, circling the battlements with a high-pitched whistle, through which Boendal detected a jangling of chainmail. Someone was hurrying toward them. He turned to see a messenger running along the battlements. It was obvious from his labored breathing that he had raced to the top of the watchtower to deliver the news.
It's over!
He shouted through the snow, his voice swelling with excitement and pride.
The news just arrived from the Black Saddle. Our warriors routed Nodon's army with the help of the elves and men.
On hearing the good tidings, the other sentries abandoned their posts and crowded around the messenger.
Nodon and his demon are dead, and the curse of the perished land has been lifted.
He scanned the sentries' faces and discovered Boendal in the crowd.
They said to tell you that Tungdil and your brother are on their way. Tungdil wants you both to go to the Grey Range. You're to rebuild Giselbert's kingdom for the dwarves.
Gripping the parapet, Boendal blinked back tears of relief. For a moment he just stood there, thanking Vrakus with all his heart for helping the dwarves to prevail. Then, remembering the warm beer, he snatched a tankard from the frame above the brazier and dipped it into the vat.
Three cheers for the dwarves!
He shouted excitedly. The others joined in and helped themselves to beer, the last of the sentries picking up the vat and draining it enthusiastically so that nothing would go to waste.
Three cheers for the children of the smith! Three cheers for the dwarves, who've killed Nodon and banished the evil from our lands!
Shouted Boendal. The sentries banged the hafts of their axes against the battlements, clinked tankards, and downed the last of their beer. The messenger smiled.
There'll be plenty of time for celebration when Her Majesty is home. I've seen the proclamation. She wants us to feast and make merry for three orbits as soon as she returns.
I've got nothing against that kind of order,
laughed the sentry. whom Boendal had talked to earlier. He stepped back to his post and winked at Boendal.
You should get some sleep. The messenger said your brother is safe and well.
The worry was gone, replaced by tiredness. A mantle of fatigue weighed on Boendal's shoulders, and he longed for his bed.
Yes, I suppose I should get some rest, he said smilingly.
He took a last look eastward, imagining where his brother might be.
At least all this suffering was worthwhile. Tungtil and the others have been through such a lot.
He filled his lungs with cold air. It tasted somehow purer and better than before.
Do you know what's strange? I always thought Tungtil would do it, but now that it's actually over, I suppose it takes a while to digest.
The sentry nodded.
I know what you mean. It's like setting out every orbit to fight a dragon, only to wake up one morning and find that he's dead. I don't know how you celebrate a thing like that.
He rested his back against the tower and smiled.
Although a bit of drinking and feasting won't go amiss. I wonder what will happen to Gerdlegard, said Boendal after a time. Maybe we'll see a new era of friendship. With the elves and the dwarves on the same side, we've never been more united. A victory like this could put a stop to our feuding.
A look of skepticism crossed the sentry's bearded face. He rubbed his nose doubtfully.
And rabbits might fly, he said in a low voice. Gerdlegard would be stronger if we were united, countered Boendal. Teon's beasts have been plaguing our borders for cycles. Just because Nodon has been defeated doesn't mean our kingdoms are safe.
He smiled at the sentry.
It's not as if we'd move in with them or anything. Perish the thought. I'm just saying, we ought to talk to them. Maybe meet with them every cycle. It might help us get along.
The sentry burped and spat over the wall. A blob of saliva flew through the air, turning into a tiny ball of ice as soon as it left his mouth, and plopping into the snow-covered fortifications below.
I suppose so,
he said hesitantly.
But the High King can take care of it. I don't want to meet any pointy ears. They're too arrogant? Conceited? Suggested Boendal.
Girly, said the sentry, pleased to have found the right word.
The humans think the elves are so creative, so arty. But what's the point of being arty if you can't defend your forests from an elf?
He thumped Boendal on the back.
You and I are made of rock. We're the opposite of girly. The pointy ears wouldn't have stood a chance at the Black Saddle if it hadn't been for us.
Boendal was about to venture a different opinion when he glimpsed something in the distance. He peered through the snow. A comet, no bigger than a coin, was shooting toward them from the east, blazing a trail through the sky.
Look,
he said to the sentry. The comet was getting closer and closer, changing from white to pink as it hurtled their way. Suddenly it flared up, dazzling them with bright red light, then burst apart. Nothing remained except a cluster of crimson dots that faded and were swallowed gradually by the dark night sky. Boendal was reminded of spattered blood.
Was it a good omen or a bad omen, do you think?
Asked the sentry uncertainly.
Well, it didn't hit us, said Boendal dryly. Which in my book makes it a good omen. Maybe Vrakas sent a spark from the eternal smithy to...
Just then, a second comet shot into view, whooshing toward them from the east. It arced through the sky, falling toward the Firstling Kingdom. This time it didn't burst apart.
By the fire of Vrakas, stammered the sentry,
gripping his shield as if a rectangle of wood and metal could protect him from a blazing orb.
Are you sure they're sparks from Vrakas's smithy, and not Teon's revenge? Look!
Shouted another sentry, alarmed.
It's falling! The burning star is falling!
It's the sun, a dwarf cried fearfully. She's rolled out of her cradle. We need to wake her up.
He brought his axe against his shield, banging frantically. The comet, which seconds ago had been no bigger than a coin, grew to the size of a leather pouch. In no time at all, it was larger than a windmill with vanes ablaze. With a roar, the comet burnt through the cloud, swooping toward the stronghold in an arc of crimson light and bathing everything beneath it, walls, watchtowers, and dwarves, in a strange red glow. In the fearsome heat, dancing snowflakes turned to raindrops and froze where they fell. Before the dwarves could draw breath, the battlements, bridges, and staircases were glazed with thick ice.
"Run for cover!" shouted Boendal, diving across the flagstones.
A sheet of ice had formed on his chainmail, fusing his helmet to his back. It shattered with a high-pitched tinkle. Skidding on his stomach across the ice, he grabbed hold of a corner of the brazier and came to a halt. The scars on his back were telling him to be careful, but he cursed them impatiently and gritted his teeth. Some of the dwarves followed his example and dived for cover, while others stared at the sky in horrified fascination, unable to move or look away. A few of the sentries, convinced that the sun had fallen from its cradle, banged their weapons against their shields to rouse the burning orb. In a shower of sparks, the shooting star sped toward them, screeching and thundering through the sky. Boendal braced himself for the impact, but the comet swooped over the stronghold and disappeared beyond the mountains to the west. But the danger hadn't passed. The tail of the comet blazed red in the sky, showering debris large enough to crush a human house. The dwarves heard a drawn-out whistle, then an ear-splitting bang. The ground shook and trembled like a frightened beast. Plumes of snow shot upward, looming like luminous towers in the dark night sky. The air hissed, and angry clouds of moisture rose from the vaporizing snow. Thick white fog wrapped itself around Boendal like a blindfold.
"To the stronghold!"
he commanded, realizing that watchtowers and battlements were no match for celestial might.
"We'll be safer inside!"
Bracing himself against the brazier, he tried to get to his feet. A moment later, one of the sentries was beside him, pulling him up. Boendal lost his bearings in the strange-smelling fog, but his companion knew the way without seeing. They ran, skidding and sliding every few paces, until they resigned themselves to crawling and pulling themselves forward on their axes.
"Quick! We need to—"
Boendal's command was cut off by a droning from above. He knew exactly what it meant. The battlements were about to be hit by a volley of burning rock. There was no time to shout a warning. The fog had already turned a muddy orange, darkening to black-streaked red as an unbearable screeching filled the air.
"Fracas protectus!"
Boendal closed his eyes as a gigantic slab of burning rock hurtled toward him. A moment later, it slammed into the solid stone walkway. Boendal heard faint shrieks as dwarves in front of him tumbled to their deaths. He couldn't see where the rock had landed because of the fog.
"Turn back!"
shouted Boendal, crawling away from the shattered stone. Hampered by his injured back, he longed for his old agility.
"To the northern walkway!"
Flagstones quaked beneath their feet as the colossal towers swayed like reeds in the breeze. Cracks opened in the groaning masonry, and sections of battlement plummeted to the ground. The bombardment continued as they hurried along the northern walkway to the highest tower. Skidding and sliding, they came to a halt at the bridge. The single-span arch construction was the only way into the kingdom and the safety of the firstling halls. Beneath the bridge was a yawning chasm, 200 paces deep. A gusty wind swept the watchtowers, chasing away the mist. At last they could see the gates leading into the mountain and safety.
"Fracas Fulfend!"
cried one of the sentries, who had turned and was pointing back to the lifting mist. The fortifications of East Ironhald were in ruins. Only 4 of the 9 towers were still standing. The rest had been crushed, toppled or flattened, leaving 5 rings of masonry protruding like rotten tooth stumps from the ground. The mighty ramparts, hewn from the mountain by dwarven masons, were riven with cracks wide enough for a band of trolls to breach the defences with ease.
"Keep moving!" Boendal urged them. "You can worry about the ramparts as soon as we've got to safety. Walls can be rebuilt."
He and the others had barely set foot on the bridge when they heard a low rumbling like distant thunder. Then the earth moved again. The falling boulders from the comet's tail had shaken the fortifications and caused the walkways to quake, but this time the tremor was deeper and more powerful, causing walls, towers, dwarves, peaks, and ridges to shudder and sway. The Red Range had stood firm for thousands of cycles, but nothing could withstand the violent quake. Most of the dwarves were knocked off their feet, hitting the flagstones in a jangling of chainmail. Axes flew through the air and clattered to the ground, while helmets collided with stone. 2 of the surviving towers collapsed with a deafening bang, raising clouds of dust that shrouded the rubble. Boendal thought of the vast orb that had passed overhead. He had only one explanation for the tremor. The comet had landed in the mountains to the west, sending shockwaves through the ground. He tried not to imagine what was happening in the underground halls and passageways, how many firstlings were dying, how many dead. The rumbling grew fainter, the quaking subsided, and at last it was still. The dwarves held their breath, waiting for what was next. An acrid smell burned their throats. The air was thick with dust from the ruined masonry, and smoke rose from scattered fires. The fearsome heat had passed with the comet, and it was snowing again. From a distance, the stillness could have been mistaken for tranquility, but it was born of destruction. Death had visited the Red Range and ravaged the Firstling's home.
"Fracas, have mercy!"
whispered Boendal's companion, his voice as sorrowful and defenseless as a child's. Boendal knew what he was thinking. Dwarves were fearless. They threw themselves into battle regardless of the odds and defended Gerdlegard against the invading hordes. Their axes and hammers brought death to the most monstrous of Teon's beasts, but no dwarven weapon could match a foe like this.
"We couldn't have stopped it," he told him. "Even Vracus can't catch a falling star."
Leaning over the bridge, he realized that the base of the tower was seriously unstable. Cracks, each as wide as an outstretched arm, had opened in the stone and were spreading through the masonry. He could almost hear it breaking.
"Quick, before the tower collapses and takes us with it!"
He set off quickly across the bridge, followed by a handful of survivors. They were almost halfway when a large clump of snow struck Boendal on the neck.
"What a time to play stupid games!"
He brushed away the snow and kept walking. The second snowball hit his left shoulder, showering him with snow. He whirled round to confront the hapless prankster.
"By the hammer of Berowyn, I'll—"
Before he could finish, the dark sky opened up and pelted him with clumps of snow. Powdery snowballs hit the bridge, his helmet, and the other dwarves. Boendal heard a faint rumbling, and the bombardment intensified. He knew what it was. The mountains, not his companions, had started the assault. Boendal's stomach lurched as he scanned the peaks around him. Although the comet had hit the ground many miles to the west, it had called forth a monster that lurked above the dwarven halls. Boendal had seen it hundreds of times while standing watch in the Secondling Kingdom. The White Death, roused by the rain and the tremors, had mounted its steed near the summit and was galloping down the slopes. In the space of 2 breaths, it filled the mountainside, crushing and consuming everything in its path. Like a vast wave, the snow rolled down the mountain, throwing up powdery spray. Everything before it was toppled, stifled, and dragged on its downward plunge.
"Run!"
shouted Boendal. His legs seemed to move of their own accord. After a few paces, he slipped over, but someone grabbed him by the plate, and he stumbled to his feet. 2 dwarves slotted their hands under his armpits and pulled him on. Driven by fear, they stumbled over the bridge, more skating than running. Even as the gates swung back to admit them, the White Death reeled them in. Hurling itself triumphantly over the precipice, it fell on the dwarves like a starving animal. Its icy body smacked into the bridge, knocking them into the chasm. Boindal's shouts were drowned out by the roaring, thundering beast. His mouth filled with snow. He clutched at the air until his right hand grabbed a falling shield which he clung to as if he were drowning. His descent was fast, so fast that his stomach was spinning in all directions. He had no way of orienting himself in the snow, but the shield cut through the powder like a spade. Tiring of the dwarf, the White Death dumped him and covered him over. The weight of the cold beast's body pushed the air from his lungs. A little while later, Boendal blacked out. Night descended on his consciousness, and his soul was ready to be summoned to Vrakas's smithy. At least it would be warm. Chapter 1. 300 miles north of Mount Blacksaddle, Kingdom of Goragar, Girdlegard, Winter, 6,235th solar cycle. A rivulet of sweat left his greasy hair, slid down his forehead, and slithered over his soot and lard-slathered skin, zigzagging past clumps of solid dirt. It ran down the bridge of his green nose, dribbled onto his upper lip, and was licked up greedily by his thick black tongue. His vile mouth stayed open as he panted for breath, exposing the full length of his tattooed tusks, a sign of high rank. His vast jaws twitched.
"Runshak!"
he thundered, gesturing for his henchmen to join him. The troop leader, putting on a burst of speed to overtake the column of marching orcs, left the path to reach the mound where his chieftain was waiting. The long march north had started at the Black Saddle, where the orcs had been defeated by an alliance of dwarves, elves, and men. They were heading for their new homeland in the Grey Range. 850 torturous miles still separated them from the stone gateway at the border with the Outer Lands. For now, they were intent on destroying their cousins, who were somewhere on the road ahead. Runshak marched up the slope and came to a halt in front of his chieftain, the great Prince Ushnots, one-time commander of 1/3 of Toboribor, the southern Orcish kingdom.
"Are we catching them?"
"Look,"
boomed Ushnots, pointing to a flat expanse of grassland amid the rolling hills. The field, 1.5 miles across, was scarred with thin black lines, narrow channels cut by meltwater that ran toward the eastern corner, seeping gradually into the soil. Although the field was grassing over, the trees and bushes were still bare, offering little protection from the wind, or shelter from enemies. Hordes of tiny black figures had taken up residence on the usually peaceful land. Runshak estimated their numbers at more than 2,000. They had set up camp and were going about their business as if they had nothing to fear. Dead wood and branches had been stacked in large pyres, from which smoke was rising in thick black columns, clearly visible in the cloudless sky. Ushnots raised a hand to his massive forehead, shielding his eyes as he focused on the activity below. Most of the milling figures were orcs. The others, shorter and less powerful, Bognilim. What they lacked in stature, they made up for in speed. But Bognilim were cowardly creatures that had to be whipped into shape.
"Northern orcs and Bognilim," he grunted scornfully. "An alliance of fools."
The northern orcs, summoned by Nodon to secure the human kingdoms, had demonstrated a fatal lack of discipline at the Black Saddle. Scrapping like wolves, while Ushnot's troopers, no less ferocious or powerful, obeyed his orders like well-trained dogs. The orcish chieftain despised the northerners, but Bognilim were worse.
"Prepare to attack. We'll strike when they fill their fat bellies and they're snoring by the fire."
Runshak nodded and charged down the slope, barking orders at the pack leaders, who relayed them in similarly boorish fashion. With a clunking of armor and jangling of chainmail, the mighty army of 5,000 orcs rearranged itself into smaller units. The archers made their way to the back. Those bearing spears and lances stood shoulder to shoulder at the front. The orcish chieftain followed the preparations approvingly, his thick black lips curling back to reveal his magnificent tusks. He was well pleased with what he saw. A growly laugh sounded from his throat. He took a deep breath and let out an almighty roar. The shuffling and stomping came to a halt. Nobody said a word.
"Nodon broke faith with us and abandoned us to our fate. The fleshlings think we're going south, but our route will take us north to found a new kingdom,"
he proclaimed, confident that the prospect of a new homeland would make them forget their tiredness and spur them into battle. He drew his notched sword and pointed at the enemy below.
"Nodon's northern lapdogs are in our way. We had to flee our homes because of those cretins. Destroy them, and the Grey Range will be ours. We'll be in our new kingdom before the fleshling soldiers are in sight of the peaks." "Ha ha ha," he laughed malevolently. "I hope they send their cavalry after us. We could do with some meat."
His troopers grunted and snarled excitedly, pounding the hafts of their spears on the ground and banging swords against shields. He raised his arm and the noise stopped abruptly. The silence was broken by a question.
"Couldn't we march past the northerners instead?"
Ushnots, who had excellent hearing, knew at once which of the 5,000 troopers had spoken the treasonous words. Cashbug was a troublemaker, who took after his father, Ragshaw. Ragshaw had met his death shortly before the Battle of the Black Saddle in circumstances not dissimilar to these, after questioning the wisdom of laying siege to a mountain. Ushnots had thought him an excellent tactician, but criticism, especially when voiced in public, was not to be tolerated. Besides, Ushnots made the decisions, and he always knew best. He had killed Ragshaw on the spot, and he was contemplating a similar fate for Cashbug.
"Silence!"
he bellowed, throwing back his head in an intimidating roar. The display made little impression on the offending orc, who stepped forward, sword in hand, shield raised defensively.
"Why not march past them and get there first? We can occupy the halls while they dash out their brains on the gates."
He stood with his legs apart, bracing himself for the blow that was bound to follow.
"It's time we did things differently, Ushnots. After what happened at the Black Saddle, we're not as strong as we were. Maybe if you'd listened to my father, we'd be back in our kingdom by now."
Several orcs grunted approvingly. For Ushnots, the interruption was unwelcome. The sweet smell of victory had soured, replaced by the reek of rebellion. He drew himself up to his full height, bared his tusks, and tensed his muscles. Then he took off, bounding down the slope and thundering to a stop in front of Cashbug.
"I've got a better plan," he snarled, squaring his shoulders.
There was a nasty glint in his yellow eyes. He made a feint with his sword, then, ducking beneath Cashbug's raised shield, he whipped out his dagger, rammed it into the trooper's armpit, and pierced his heart. Green blood gushed from the wound, and the insolent trooper thudded to the ground.
"My plan is this. Cashbug dies first, just like his know-it-all father at the Black Saddle."
He glared at the others, challenging them to object.
"Anyone else want to talk tactics?"
He wasn't surprised when no one stepped forward. The real shock came a moment later when the dead orc stood up. Cashbug reached to his armpit and touched the wound with his claws. It healed straight away. Ushnots got over his confusion faster than Cashbug, who was clearly amazed to be alive. He rammed his sword horizontally into the injured orc's torso. The trooper sat down heavily and stared at the blood. He still showed no signs of dying.
"I'm sick of your troublemaking," shrieked Ushnots, grabbing him by the collar and dragging him to his feet. "How dare you defy orders? I told you to die."
The notched sword cut into the trooper's torso, but the damage was far from fatal. Cashbug opened his mouth, dribbling blood and saliva. Then he laughed. Straightening up, he gave the chieftain a shove.
"Tion has made his choice. Why else would he make me immortal? My father's death must be avenged." He raised his shield and sword. "Tion wants me to lead the orcs to victory. The northern kingdom will be mine." "Why would Tion favor a bone-headed simpleton like you?" growled Ushnots, preparing to fight.
None of his troopers dared to take sides. Orcs were always arguing, but this was different.
"You're hiding something, aren't you?"
"He drank dark water from the ditch," called one of the troopers.
"It was hallowed water. I knew as soon as I saw it," said Cashbug, thumping the leather container on his belt. "I filled my pouch with it."
He struck out at the chieftain, who blocked the blow and smashed the hilt of his sword into his face. Cashbug stumbled backward, groaning.
"Dark water!"
barked Ushnots. He had noticed it as well. Murky puddles on either side of the track. Nothing would have induced him to drink it.
"It's the blood of the perished land," said his challenger, "and I, Cashbug, was elected to find it."
He sprang forward, swinging his sword. Ushnots flung himself to the ground and drove both boots into the trooper's knees, smashing the joints. Cashbug screeched. The noise ended suddenly as Ushnots dealt a long, sweeping blow to his neck. The trooper's head fell one way, his body the other. This time, Cashbug was dead. Ushnots bent over the corpse, unhooked the water pouch, and signaled to one of his underlings.
"Here, drink this," he said.
The trooper took the pouch. Screwing up his face in disgust, he took a sip. Black water dribbled from his mouth, and he coughed.
"It tastes like the smell of troll's piss. Only wo-"
Ushnots stabbed him, ramming the dagger into his heart. He watched impassively as the trooper fell to the ground. The blade was still embedded in his flesh. After a while, his eyelids fluttered, and he raised his head. The blood stopped pouring from his chest.
"Well?"
asked Ushnots suspiciously.
I'm alive," said the orc, his voice a mixture of horror and pain.
Then he realized his newfound power. Roaring with triumph, he bared his tusks and brandished the pouch.
"I'm alive! The dark water made me!"
Ushnots took hold of his dagger, pulled it out of the screaming orc's chest. and lopped off his head. He caught the pouch quickly and raised it to his lips, draining its contents. Then he hurled it to the ground. He didn't feel any different, but he was certain of the effect. As a former prince of Toboribor, he deserved to be immortal.
A leader like me needs an indestructible army.
He decided to obtain more of the water for his troops. Leaving the troopers without a word, he lumbered up the slope to survey the enemy camp and wait for an opportunity to attack. The northern orcs were gorging themselves on human flesh. Ushnots, his stomach rumbling, breathed in the smell of roasting meat. He and his troopers had been nourishing themselves on whatever crossed their path, animals, snails, and beetles. Fleshlings were a rare delicacy, because the northerners seldom left anything in their wake. The inhabitants of three villages, a small town, and a hamlet had been slaughtered and eaten by the marauding troops. Ushnots was surprised at their pillaging. It was bound to provoke the fury of the fleshling kings. The fleshlings, on their own, weren't much of a threat. Ushnots thought them feeble and clumsy, but it was imperative for his troops to reach the Grey Range before the united army of Girdlegard noticed and hunted them down. If it came to a battle, he wanted to be protected by the sturdy defences of a dwarven stronghold at the heart of a mountain range. With any luck, the other princes of Toboribor would keep Girdlegard's warriors busy for a while. The sun, tired from another long orbit, was dropping toward the horizon. Soon she would retire to bed, making way for the stars to populate the heavens. The time for battle was approaching. Ushnots bellowed for Runshak and briefed him on the plan of attack. Just then the wind changed, blowing a new smell to the hilltop where Ushnots and Runshak were stationed. They sniffed inquiringly, their broad nostrils flaring until at last they were sure. The air smelled of horses, armour, and sweat. Fleshling sweat.
"They're coming from the south,"
snarled Runshak, turning to face the string of hills to their right.
"Confounded fleshlings. The united army."
Although Ushnots could smell, but not see the new arrivals, he knew at once that his troopers were outnumbered. Even as he resigned himself to beating a hasty retreat, he realized that the enemy was hounding a different quarry.
"We'll wait," he said.
"You mean they haven't seen us?"
asked Runshak, surprised.
"It's not us they're looking for. They're after the orcs who left those tracks,"
he grinned. A few miles earlier, he had decided to stop tailing the northerners and lead his troopers across a river. The fast-flowing water had washed away their scent. Clearly, the fleshlings' scouts hadn't thought to look for two separate armies, or his troopers would surely have been attacked. He congratulated himself on his guile. Runshak growled uneasily and raised his nose to the wind.
"The smell's getting stronger. They're still advancing. It won't be much longer until they attack."
He looked expectantly at Ushnots.
"As soon as they've started fighting, we'll jump in and teach those fleshlings a lesson."
"No," said Ushnots. "The northerners can deal with them. We'll see how they fare."
He took a silent decision to resume the march that night if the united army proved victorious. It suited his purposes for the soft-skinned fleshlings to believe that this part of Girdlegard had been purged of his race. He would never admit as much to Runshak, but Kashbug had been right in one respect. The Battle of the Black Saddle had weakened his army. It was time to change tactics. But Ushnots knew how to develop his own strategies without a jumped-up trooper telling him so.
"We'll stay out of sight. The fleshlings won't know we're here, and they'll head south. As soon as it's safe, we'll march north and find more of that water, enough for all of us. No army will be powerful enough to defeat us, and when we're ready, we'll claim the lives that we spared tonight.
He turned his head, looking over the fat encrusted surface of his epaulet. His yellow eyes focused on the troublemaker's corpse, and he grunted contentedly. Cashbug and the ill-fated victim of his experiment with the water would be the only troopers to die that night. Prince Malin was waiting with his cavalry 50 or so paces from the brow of the hill. The enemy was camped on the other side, watched by two of his scouts who were crouched on the hilltop, assessing the size of the army, which had been known to them only by the boot prints on the ground. Malin had decided to hunt down the fleeing orcs and Bognilim and put a stop to their pillaging. From what he had seen over the past few orbits, the beasts had lived too long already. They left nothing but carnage in their wake. The first of the scouts crawled backward down the hillside to make his report.
2,000 of them, Prince Malin. They've been feasting by the looks of it, and now they're dozing around their fires.
So, there aren't 5,000 as we thought,
said Malin, sitting upright in the saddle. His mount snorted gratefully, glad of the shift in weight. After a long ride without any rest to speak of, the horses were wearier than the men. Until that moment, the wind had been blowing toward them, but now it buffeted them from behind. The air was mild and smelled of the coming spring.
The ground was muddy, remember? Said the scout. The soil is soggy with melting snow. You sink deeper than usual. Besides, the green-hided beasts are bigger than us and their armor is heavy.
His eyes swept the rows of horsemen.
2,000 of them, Prince Malin. No more than 2,000 and no fewer.
The Ido flag, carried proudly by one of Malin's riders, was fluttering in the wind, betraying the southerly change. Malin cursed. Orcs had an excellent sense of smell and could sniff out their victims from a distance. They were bound to detect the waiting men. Malin's finely crafted armor, engraved with the insignia of the Ido, gleamed in the light of the setting sun. He unbuckled his old-fashioned helmet from his belt, set it on his head, and fastened the chin strap. His careful handling of the headpiece showed his respect for the royal crest, which had been in his family for generations, surviving the centuries unchanged. His riders, seeing the prince's blonde hair disappear beneath his helmet, prepared themselves for battle. Malin heard the clunking of weaponry and jangling of armor behind him, and gave the order to attack.
"Archers to the front!" he said resolutely. "Advance to the hilltop, but stay out of sight. Foot soldiers, go with them!"
He turned to the right.
"First unit, ride in and attack. Slash, jab, and do whatever you can to bait them. But turn and flee as soon as they fight back. The dolts will follow, and we'll be waiting for them. Don't let any escape."
He nodded briskly, and the first 150 riders charged up the hill, exploding over the crest and careering down the other side to blast through the enemy camp like a hoofed gust of death. Eyes closed, Malin listened to their progress. He heard pounding hooves, cries of terror from the orcs, and high-pitched screams from the cowardly Bognilim. A moment later, swords met with armor and shields. The clamor intensified. 100 voices became 1,000 as the excited beasts threw themselves wildly on the small band of riders who had ventured foolishly into their camp. The thundering horseshoes grew louder, accompanied by shouts and jeers from the pursuing beasts. Malin raised his arm, lifting his sword high in the air. He heard the archers knock their arrows and level their bows. The first beasts had yet to crest the hill when Malin brought his sword down sharply, and 300 arrows soared through the air, falling steeply over the hilltop, and raining vertically on the startled wave of orcs and Bognilim. The first flurry was followed by a second and a third. Malin listened in satisfaction to the beast's dying screams. Meanwhile, the riders galloped back and took their place among the ranks.
"Ride!" he shouted. "Death to the beasts of Teon! Ride!"
Opening his eyes, he took a deep breath.
"For Ido and for Gerdlegard!"
He reached back to tap his horse with the flat of his sword, and they galloped away. The whinnying steed was joined by 500 others. The prince's cavalry poured over the hill in a stream of glittering silver. The drumming of 2,000 hooves shook the earth, striking fear into the hearts of the approaching beasts. The orcs and Bognilim turned tail and fled, but there was no escape from the onslaught of spears, armored horses, and steel. The stragglers were the first to die. The rest were trampled a few paces later. The air was wet with green blood, but neither the screams of the dying nor the sight of the wounded could slow the riders' advance.
"He could have waited for us,"
grumbled Boindil Doubleblade of the clan of the Swinging Axes. The secondling warrior was making his way to the surface with incredible speed.
"The cavalry has attacked. I can hear the horses."
He gripped the metal rungs with his powerful fingers, climbing hand over hand. The only light in the shaft came from chinks around the doorway. It was barely enough to illuminate the ladder, but Boindil, like all dwarfs, was accustomed to seeing in the gloom.
"What if the Longuns finish them off before we get there?" he said anxiously.
Tungdil Goldhand, climbing behind him, tried not to laugh. He knew that his friend was desperate to fight. The hot-blooded Boindil, known to his kinfolk as Ireheart, pursued his enemies with a vengeance and was bent on waging war.
"I had a word with Prince Malin. He promised to leave some for you."
Ireheart snorted, his long black plate swinging across his back.
"You shouldn't make fun of me," he called back grouchily, climbing faster than before.
He let out an excited shriek.
"I think they're right above us! I can smell their stinking armor!"
The weight of his chainmail, shield, and axes seemed not to bother him. One hand was already reaching for the door. A moment later, he found the bolt and opened the hatch. He poked his helmed head tentatively into the open.
"What can you see?"
panted Tungdil, whose muscles were tiring.
"Any sign of the orcs?"
"We've died and gone to Vrakas's smithy,"
whooped Boindil. With a blood-curdling
"Oink!"
he catapulted himself out of the shaft like a dwarven cannonball.
"Stand clear, you little runts! I'm coming!"
Craning his neck, Tungdil looked up and saw the secondling silhouetted against the light. He seemed to be brandishing both axes as he flew through the air. Tungdil turned back to the others.
"Quick! After him!"
He hauled himself out of the shaft. He hadn't expected the situation to be good, but it was worse than he had imagined. He was standing in an encampment of shrieking Bognilim and angry orcs. Tungdil's notion of the eternal smithy was rather different. As soon as he was clear of the shaft, he reached behind him and drew his axe from the sheath on his back. The diamond-encrusted blade glittered fiercely in the crimson light of the dying sun. At the sight of keen fire, the orcs pulled up abruptly, grunting and shuffling back. They knew they were dealing with no ordinary warrior. Every beast in Gerdlegard had heard how Tungdil Goldhand had slain the Dark Magus and sliced the demon in half with a glittering blade. Crafted by the best dwarven artisans, with a blade made from the purest steel and forged in the fiercest furnace, encrusted with diamonds and inlaid with precious metals and tionium, Keenfire was a weapon of untold power and strength. The beasts were right to be afraid. Summoning his courage, an orc stepped forward to challenge its bearer. He swung his cudgel with a snarl.
"Ah, a hero," growled Tungdil.